On May 2, 2007, Jonathan Porritt spoke in Vancouver, Canada, at a theater in the Round. His topic? A sustainable future. Whose business is it anyway? That 44-minute talk is available from the Radio EcoShock website at www.ecoshock.org in the Climate Solutions section. Now we listen to the first part of the question and answer period, where invited experts and citizens began a dialogue on sustainability and world issues with Porritt, who is the head of the British Sustainable Development Commission, a founder of the Green Party movement in the UK, and a former director of Friends of Earth UK. His latest book is Capitalism as If It Mattered.
To say a word in response, our academic vice president, John Waterhouse, who also has served the university as dean of business.
Jonathan, it's my great pleasure to not actually respond, that's not how Paul described my task earlier, but rather simply on behalf of those assembled here to thank you for a most interesting and provocative and enlightening presentation. I can't help but relate back to the early part of your presentation in which you talked about those who respond and talk to the more negative side of motivation versus those who need a more positive, positive frame. And I must admit that I put myself firmly in the latter camp. Namely, I have to think that a more cheerful and positive future is indeed possible. As you point out, discontinuity does create new opportunity. It creates new opportunity even for capital, for technology, and for innovation. Politicians, perhaps even the odd Canadian one, although I think they're very odd at this point, as well as consumers are learning from our thought leaders and from you that change is necessary if our world is to be sustainable. It seems that humankind will have to both mitigate and adapt its behavior if it's to overcome some of the negative changes in our world. In some areas, such as climate change, as you point out, it is all too clear that the consequences cannot, at this stage, not be completely mitigated. It's here with us. And so it does seem to me that regardless of these mitigation attempts, we're going to have to develop adaptation mechanisms if we're to survive. Examples of things that it seem at this point to be beyond mitigation, the spread of West Nile virus. Here in British Columbia, the pine beetle epidemic. Here also in Vancouver, we're soon to be affected by sea level rises. So the question is, how does proactive policy planning develop, and how is industry, government, and our community to adapt effectively if we are to survive? And how do we in the universities equip our policymakers with the analytical frameworks and with the thought processes to permit the development of policies in these areas? Perhaps there's some limited evidence that we at SFU have not completely sold out. We have formed the Adaption to Climate Change team in response to this challenge. ACT is steered by SFU's public policy program in conjunction with leading researchers on climate change from several SFU departments. And it is designed to generate policy options for Canadian and other policymakers in their process of adapting to climate change. Policy issues will be considered and policy options generated in areas such as food and energy production, fresh water supply, health, new technologies, and displaced populations. ACT is scheduled to be launched this fall with a segment called Communities in Jeopardy, Plant, Animal, and Human. Although the series overall is national and international in focus, the first segment will focus here on Pacific Northwest issues. It is the leading edge thinking of people such as Jonathan Porritt who have provided the inspiration for this and many more such initiatives. Once again, Jonathan, please accept our sincere thanks, and I look forward very much to the following discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. We have three persons to kick off the dialogue, representing different sectors of the community. David Zandvliet, the folks are sitting to my left in this row. David Zandvliet, next to John Waterhouse, is a faculty member in our Faculty of Education who's responsible for environmental and ecological education and goes all around this part of the world and other parts of the world with our field school program teaching about these issues. Les Dukowski, who stepped away and will be right back, is the president of the BC Principals and Vice Principals Association, who is a partner organization with us and a proud collaborator for us in issues affecting education here in the province. And Robert Safrata, at the end of this row, is the CEO of Novex Delivery Services and recently participated in one of Al Gore's boot camps, and so has personal experience of how the movement is going from that point of view. Now, what we've asked them to do is to warm up the crowd and get the discussion going with questions and comments. And pretty quickly, however, we'll be returning to you as a group so that we can take advantage of this magnificent facility and engage Jonathan Porritt in some dialogue, Vancouver style. So, David, would you kick us off with your remarks?
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks, Jonathan, for very provocative talk. A couple of points came to mind when you were talking. One, educational philosopher David Orr in 1994 wrote a book called Earth in Mind, and he said something very similar to what you were saying. He said, the environment was not a problem for education, it's a problem with education. And he was speaking to the fact that most of the environmental injustice in the world is precipitated by some of the most educated people in the world. So he was kind of structuring this as an educational problem. And you also mentioned Richard Louv's term nature deficit disorder from the last year's book, Last Child in the Forest, as being maybe part of the problem. I was struck with your notion that there's this 20-year delay between the action and consequences, both in the environmental field, but also in the educational field. In BC, we've had a document in 1995 called Environmental Concepts in the Classroom, which, if you knew it was there, you could find it and use it, but most people, including ministry staff, didn't know it was there. I've been the lead writer for a revision which is just about to be published called Environmental Learning and Experience, which gets to the point of kind of this direct experience in nature as being important for teaching and values being important related to environmental issues. So from where I'm standing, the environment is definitely an educational reform issue, and there's a bunch of things that fly in the way of that happening, things like disciplinary curriculum frameworks that are getting more and more packed with content, high-stakes testing, and the trend towards larger urbanized schools at the expense of smaller rural schools. So my question is, if we're to move this forward, what can we do in the educational sector, in particular K-12, to start moving this in another direction?
I thought I might get some breathing space to work out the answer to that one. No, it's fine. Well, it is difficult for me to pretend again that I could answer that from a Canadian perspective. I guess what I'm reflecting here in terms of the European experience is that the content bit of it, as you described it, the curriculum reform bit, has actually been going reasonably well. And most governments of Western European countries have lightened up about bringing a lot of environmental content into the curriculum at different points, particularly at the elementary, at the primary school level. I mean, most primary schools now are little sort of, how can I describe them? I mean, they are amazing. You sort of see children emerging from primary schools, elementary schools, all fired up about the relationship with the natural world. And our government in the UK is quite keen on this. They've just launched something called the Green Detective Kit, which I touched on this morning at the conference for the 30 Days of Sustainability, which I've looked at that in detail, and quite honestly, I'm astonished that any government would fire up young kids between the age of 5 and 11 with this little tool, because basically it turns them into steamy little green zealots who are going to go out there and hunt down environmental malpractice in their homes. So parents first in line in their schools, because the whole detective kit is to say, is your school working in an environmentally responsible way? And then it tells the kids how to go and find out that it's not. You know, go and ask the head teacher how much CO2 your school is emitting every year. So you can imagine head teachers are going to be really cross about this in Senate. But this is now licensed activism on the part of very young children. And I'm astonished by that readiness to bring content in. The next stage is much harder, which you were touching on, is that schools are not yet embodiments of green practice. They do not provide the surrounding context in which any young person can understand what living a more environmentally and socially responsible life looks like. And that's really problematic. And lastly, the relationship between schools and communities remains very vexed, where schools are not properly, in many cases in Europe, are not embedded in the community in such a way as to share some of the sustainability challenges at the local level. I'm quite encouraged that things are changing, and I'm quite encouraged to hear of your new version. I actually have seen the document you're talking about. Well, Milt sent it to me, I think, so I read that dutifully. And I thought that was really impressive to get that content element in, but the practice bit is crucial. And you made a comment about urban and rural. Our experience in Europe, I don't know if it's yours, is that many rural schools can be as detached from a proper embedded understanding of our relationship with and embeddedness in nature as urban schools, which is a real bit of a sort of counterintuitive shock, really.
Well, Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us here in British Columbia. It's great that you're here to speak with us this evening. I believe everyone in the room that the public education is the foundation of a free liberal society, and it may be the fact that we have become educated and able to engage in activities, economic activities that give us the leisure time to enjoy more, that have actually led to the problem, at the same time being the ultimate solution to the situation we found ourselves. When you describe public education of 20 years ago as being polluted, I thought to myself, well, I was in the system 20 years ago teaching. I felt like I had to come to the need to the defense of the system, and then wondered if I was a victim of multiple denial syndrome of myself. But at any rate, one of the major tasks of public education is to not only inform citizens to make good choices, but also to narrow the gap and offer equity of opportunity. No, not just equity of opportunity, but actually equity of attainment, so that we can maintain a civil society, because we know that those gaps between have and have not, rich and poor, educated and non-educated, are what are going to lead to conflict, hence the wariness of Europe with the increasing imbalance between its population and its neighbors. I guess my question is a bit of a variant on David's. I was very, very happy to see that your values, you talked about public education, at least what I took to be public education, to be having to be mediated by some values. And I would appreciate if you would mind expanding on that a little bit. I think that the notion of values education in schools is a bit of a sensitive one. I will point out, however, that our organization sponsors a project called Student Voice, where we gather students from around the province to actually advise government. And one of the things that we did this year was talk to kids about compassion. We had the Dalai Lama here earlier in the year, and we've seen some very tangible results of teaching youngsters about what we believe would be reasonable values that cut across ethnic and cultural gender lines and so forth. So on that topic values, introducing values into the curriculum to inform the use of the knowledge that students gain. Can you offer us a little bit of insight into that?
Yeah, that's certainly controversial. I imagine, like you do, we have a real tussle about the extent to which those values that I just showed there for a moment constitute a subversive dismantling of today's orthodoxy, economic, political, neoliberal orthodoxy, or whether, in fact, they reflect a deeper level of meaning, a deeper way of understanding relationship between us and other people and other life forms, which needn't necessarily be seen as a threat to orthodox political and economic mindsets. And that's a really interesting issue for me. I mean, I was struck by, I mean, I'm being a bit mean about Arnie Schwarzenegger, but the truth is, in this really difficult world of ours, leadership from right-wing parts of the political spectrum, neoliberal parts of the political spectrum, is peculiarly more effective than some of the leadership from the liberal progressive parts of the political spectrum. And the reason for that, I think, is very clear, that partly it's counterintuitive. People don't expect it to come from that place. And secondly, what it demonstrates by implication is compatibility between a different way of conceptualizing the relationship between humankind and other people, the rest of life on Earth, which needn't necessarily be seen as ideologically unacceptable, improper, not manageable in today's world. So you might hope that we would begin to see a loosening of the defenses that have been built around schools, around educational establishments, when it comes to bringing those values to bear on the educational endeavors of each of those establishments. But I know that's very difficult. I taught for 10 years in a high school, a state high school in London, and I can't help but recall the degree to which I was discouraged in my efforts to bring a values-based approach to teaching into my own classroom and the school as a whole. I had to become a practicing subversive at every point. And as a teacher of English and drama, that wasn't that difficult, because one can summon up astonishing resources from the wonderful literary heritage that we have. It's amazing how you can make literature the tool of practically any single values proposition you wish to entertain. So I probably had a slightly easier walk on down that particular road than others might. But I know how controversial this is, and it touches also on the issue of balance, which hasn't come up yet. But do schools have a duty to reflect the balance of the debate? You know, must they continue, for instance, to bring into the school these contrary, I'm trying to speak in an objective and balanced way here, these dissenting voices about climate change? Should every school give airspace to those people who think that it's all to do with solar radiation and sunspots? And the fact that Mars, as somebody told me on CKNW today, have I got those initials right? That's lucky. On CKNW today, the fact that Mars is now a little bit warmer than it was 100 years ago is final, definitive proof that climate change is caused by increased solar radiation from the sun and nothing to do with the emission of man-made greenhouse gases. That was quite a facer for me. I certainly learned something today, but I will go away and reflect on that in the balanced, objective way that you would expect me to. But should schools do this, or should schools say, here's the reality, kids. This is what's happening. Yes, there's still a debate about it. You need to be informed about the debate. But basically, this is the best state of knowledge we have available to us. This is the deal now. It's uncomfortable. It's inconvenient. But here's what the deal is. This is a very difficult issue. And educators have a really hard job, I think, managing that balance argument, their responsibilities as educators, as well as, how can I put this without falling over the edge into proselytizers, their values shapers, as well as neutral disseminators of information. And I do hold very strongly to that view of education as a means by which values are instilled and reinforced in young people, not rather than teachers as neutral conduits through which scientific empirical data is transmitted. I can't go anywhere else as an ex-teacher. That's what made me fired up as a teacher. If I'd just been a kind of pipe down which tons of stuff knowledge was being neutrally transmitted. It doesn't sound like much of a game plan, really, for young teachers, does it? Well, sorry, not for me anyway.
Don't worry, you couldn't be that way if you tried. I'm going to ask Saeed to put that last slide up again on the screens. I notice it's still on the computer, and I don't know that people got to see that as much as would be of value to them about the values. Yes, I made him get out of his chair and run over and have to put that back up. But the values Jonathan talked about, it's quite a wonderful list. I can see it up here, and I put it in my notes. Well, it'll appear in a moment. In the meantime, if Les is done, we'll move on to Robert.
Good evening. It's great to be here. And you've certainly attracted the A-team, a quick scan of the audience of some people I met briefly. It's really a fabulous crowd here tonight, and I'm looking forward to your questions and the dialogue, so I'll go quickly as well. I would like to start with a question to give you that little bit of time. And my question is going to be from page 296 and 97 of your book. You remember that. It goes like this. The sentence, paragraph goes like this. For some, however, this is all so much moonshine, as are all the transitional strategies for government, business, and civil society. However much sense they might make, however desirable and even preferable they might be, there is one overwhelmingly powerful reason why they are seen to be doomed to failure.
Human nature.
And I'm here because I'm a business person. I run a company called Novex Courier, and because of the efforts and the success we've had in the last 5 years to become as environmentally responsible a company as we can be and continue to be. And believe me, we run into that human nature and the people that work with us all the time and our customers. I think, though, the question tonight is, whose business is it anyway? And I do, and we have taken the tack that it is business, the business of business, and our business. And 20 years ago, I wasn't running a company. I wasn't in a place where I could have as much influence as I have had the last 5 years to absolutely demand and make things happen. So I really think, you know, the students that are being taught, I borrowed materials from my teenager schools 4 years ago to learn about for what we were going to do in our business. So they have it in the schools, but my kids aren't running the joint yet. And they don't have the influence. So the businesses have to be at it now. And hopefully we can be a great example to others and say, look, if we did it, why the heck aren't you? And that we're making bigger business and more money, that kind of thing. So, and I think the businesses are the polluters and the producers of what humans consume, what they shop for. And I agree with you, the affluenza. So will leaders, CEOs, act out of fear, risk, you know, from special interest groups, shareholder attacks, obsolete products eventually? Or will they act, or can they act, and I know we did this, out of opportunity, out of the right thing to do? It started with that, differentiating ourselves. Pride is a huge element in our business now. So I'm going to finish with a gift that when you were speaking, I really thought I would love to read this. And this is the gift I'd like to leave tonight. It's a poem by a woman named Linda Ellis called The Dash. It goes like this. I read of a man who stood to speak at the funeral of his friend. He referred to the dates on her tombstone from the beginning to the end. He noted that first came the date of her birth and spoke the second with tears. But he said that what mattered most of all was the dash between those years. For that dash represents all the time that she spent alive on this earth. And now only those who loved her know what that little line is worth. For it matters not how much we own, the hybrid cars, the house, the cash. What matters is how we live in love and how we spend our dash. So think about this long and hard. Are there things you'd like to change? For you never know how much time is left that can still be rearranged. If we just slow down enough to consider what's true and real and always try to understand the way other people feel, be less quick to anger and show appreciation more, and love the people in our lives like we've never loved before. If we treat each other with respect and more often wear a smile, remembering that this special dash might only last a little while. So, when your eulogy is being read, with your life's actions to rehash, would you be pleased with the things they have to say about how you spent your dash. And that coming from a business person.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. Well, just to pick up specifically on the point about the business end of that, I think we might come on to the broader question about human nature in the discussions. Because actually so many of these debates, when you really try and penetrate through what it is that somebody's feeling about this, what they're saying to you about it, when you really strip away some of the superficial arguments, what you usually get down to is differentiated interpretations of human nature. So the feasibility of the journey that I was talking about this evening, the viability of making that change for 6 to 9 billion people is largely a function of how you feel about human nature. Well, if you embrace one set of mindsets about human nature, you'll go one way, and et cetera, et cetera. On the business front, this is really interesting to me, and I'm empowered today by what business is doing, because it is a lot more than what business has ever done before. And there are some fantastic examples of companies that are really beginning to make sense of this agenda. This is not greenwash. Yes, there's lots of greenwash out there, obviously. You've got to expect that. There are lots of people claiming things they're not really delivering. There are lots of people are blowing trumpets that should have been kept in the cupboard. All that kind of stuff's going to go on for a long time. Don't worry too much about that. Because at the same time, there is really serious corporate engagement in a lot of these issues. Now, most of it is premised at the moment, quite properly, on the discovery that they can get good at a lot of this agenda without imperiling any of their commercial and business priorities. No downside at all. No increased costs incurred, no increased regulatory risk, no damage of losing customers, no sense of shareholders, if they have them, shareholder anger or opposition to this, because most shareholders, when they come to see that it's compatible with the notion of value creation over time, they don't usually dig in and say, we don't want you being a responsible company, we want you being a good old-fashioned irresponsible company that we knew and loved. That's not really what shareholders do, as long as they don't see their interests jeopardized. So right now, most of this agenda is being delivered by a win-win congruence between commercial interests and doing a better job vis-a-vis society and the environment. I call that the low-hanging fruit agenda. It's easily available to us and nobody gets hurt. Fantastic stuff. But when you think about what we've got to do, it isn't always going to be like that. There are going to be trade-offs. There are going to be winners and losers. And I get quite nervous about what I call this Pollyanna-ish school of sustainability through business ingenuity. Because there will be many, many losers in this transition to a sustainable world. Many losers. A lot of companies will go out of business. A lot of shareholders will have their fingers burnt. A lot of people will find their prospects, financial prospects, severely damaged by the need to move societies forward in different ways. And we have to accept that. And oddly enough, the interesting thing is, all good, self-respecting capitalists ought to celebrate that, because that is actually a manifestation of capitalism working at its most effective. If you really subscribe to the tenets of capitalism, you ought to be out there separating what Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction. Get out the way. If you're no longer able to create value for society and shareholders or people in your company, if you can't create value in a way that meets the needs of this generation, if you were part of the old system, get out the way. There are new people who want to create value differently. And I've started kind of getting quite excited about the notion of there being something inherent in the system of capitalism, which actually might accelerate change processes more than would be the case in any other economic system. Now, the only problem is you've got to let the markets work, and you've got to make the markets effective and transparent. And the reason why, if you do start to have a hard time of the journey you're on at the moment, I'm not sure whether you've already hit some of these slightly trickier bits, now you've got all the low-hanging fruit neatly harvested. The reason why it'll get a bit harder is because prices do not reflect costs in our markets today. And you can't have market-based solutions to problems unless prices reflect cost. So the job of politicians is to internalize costs, to regulate and incentivize change processes so that prices reflect cost, and then entrepreneurs and businesses will be able to go on improving the offer to society, to their business partners, without jeopardizing their own position competitively for those who go on externalizing costs. That's the issue. So I want to celebrate the achievements of business so far. I think they can go a lot further, but ultimately, unpopular view though this may be, governments will have to regulate markets to make it possible for responsible entrepreneurs to thrive and irresponsible entrepreneurs to die. I don't mean physically die. I mean their businesses to die.
But Jonathan, if I may follow up at this point, are our governments operating in a straightforward manner? I come from the United States, and we're very concerned now. It takes $1 billion to have a presidential race, and that money goes to buying influence. Are our governments, you know the UK, you can at least speak for the UK, are the politicians able to function in the best interests of the voters and society, or as is illustrated in Joel Bacon's film The Corporation, are we in a kind of a deathlock with corporations who are buying influence faster than the public can neutralize it with our political leaders?
Yeah, big issue. It doesn't cost quite $1 billion in the UK, but sort of we're in that pork barrel stuff as well. I mean, we act terribly pompously pious about the superiority of our democratic systems. I mean, when you look at the degree of co-option of politicians in this orthodox economic system, it's pretty deep. And I think you raise an enormously, enormously important issue. And in the book, I have touched a lot on this because I'm very, very concerned about the degree to which now big business and its tight, interlocked relationship with politicians is now so overwhelming that I sometimes wonder whether we can actually break out of it. The buying price now for different positions in the political system is so great that sometimes you think, well, how could any politician come through the system unless he or she was prepared to toe the line vis-a-vis a form of economic and business orthodoxy that clearly isn't going to get us to this sustainable future? I think it's a very, very big challenge for legislators, for politicians seeking to do a better job. I personally think we've just gone through the worst ever patch in that excessively friendly relationship between business and politicians. I think the pendulum is going to swing back again. I've noticed the debate in America. People don't like the idea that they live in a bought democracy. They feel deeply uneasy about this. Even very right-wing, neoliberal conservative voters, particularly people who come from the evangelical part of the religious side of America, are not at all happy about being seen to be represented by people who've bought their way to positions of power. That doesn't work in terms of the value systems that they subscribe to. It doesn't work. And I think maybe I'm just being excessively optimistic here, but I think we will see a swing of that pendulum back towards a system in which money is taken out to a certain extent from the system, political system, and we revert to a system which people can stand as of right, as prospective representatives of people without necessarily having to have billions of dollars behind them. But that's going to be a hard call, and if we can't do that as part of the governance transition, then a sustainable society looks much harder to get to than it would be otherwise.
Well, it's your turn, and I'll try to keep a list of people in the order they signal they'd like to speak, who would like to make a comment or ask a question to move our discussion forward. I'll go here and then to Mark, and then we'll come here and here, okay? And then I'll call for another show of hands.
Yes, can you hear me? I must say I thoroughly enjoyed this evening's presentation by you, Mr. Porritt, and as well as the other speakers. I do want to follow through, though, with something that Robert Sofrata mentioned, and that is talking about human nature. My concern is, if we go back for a moment to the Bill and Hillary Clinton situation in the States with their proposal for a national health system and how the insurance industry came up with every possible piece of disinformation they could find in their videos in order to bring that proposal down. I think it's a difference between highly seductive, emotional advertising versus, and in this case, a very rational problem. We're talking about something that is terribly important, but it isn't here. It's over there. It's Katrina. It's Iraq. It's Afghanistan. How are we going to be able to balance out the difference between getting people to accept that even though the problem isn't here yet, it is still as important for us to consider it as it is to recognize that the opposition is terribly, terribly, what shall I say, they're very well organized in knowing how to seduce the public. How are we going to be able to compete with them with something that has a rational basis, not an emotional basis?
We're going to have several comments before Jonathan responds. Mark?
I'm very struck by the fact that you don't stick at sustainability, which is a broad enough objective, heaven knows, but that you are careful to include equity and compassion in your notion of the kind of world you think we ought to be trying for. And when I think about the role that education has in relationship to the kind of world you talk about wanting, it seems to me that there's another gap that hasn't really been mentioned that we might want to consider. It could be considered a skills gap. It's not just values, but the education system, the way it's constructed at present, tends to separate people out. It institutionalizes them, of course, but it also tends to separate them out into groups that have fairly narrowly shared interests and specialties and areas of knowledge. And then they get out and people come out of the system and end up in the world working in enclaves that gather together engineers or doctors or specialists of various kinds, where they interact primarily with each other and have small interesting battles with adjoining professions like doctors and nurses and so on. But people, in my experience, I work with a lot of resource companies, and people in those resource companies that genuinely want to be responsive to the communities they work with in some cases and are working to create a more sustainable world like many other people are very poorly equipped to be able to communicate effectively, to build alliances across differences, whether they're differences of professions or whether they're cultural differences or differences between capitalist corporate organizations and community organizations. And it seems to me that that's one of the ways in which the educational system as a whole and the institutions we're part of tend to work against the kind of vision you're arguing for. So I'd be interested in your comments on that.
We had two comments over here before we give Jonathan the floor.
Thank you. I'm Emmanuel Prene. I was listening to the French news this morning, and the chief economist of one of France's biggest banks said that the population in the European Union will be declining over the next 20 to 30 years, and that this is a huge problem for consumption, for jobs, for pensions, for economic growth. And this seems to be a prevalent point of view from the conventional economic perspective. And I wanted to know how do you argue for the ecological bottom line with economic thinkers who believe you need population growth to pull the economy upwards?
I'm Vanessa Timmer. First of all, thank you very much. This was fascinating. I really enjoyed the presentation. And I zeroed in on your comment on the taboo subject of less consumption. And my question to you is, what would your strategy be for approaching this taboo subject? And have you come across in your work in the UK and internationally brave souls who've taken this on and succeeded to tackle the issue of less consumption? Thank you.
Right. okay, well, they're all interconnected, those questions, which is very helpful.
If I can start from this business about how can we deal with, in a way, reflecting on what you were saying, Paul, how can we deal with the very, very powerful corporate interests, especially when they've got a job on their hands to defend the vested privileges that they have through that economy? And there is no magic answer to that, as you know. We simply have to get used to the fact that civic society is going to have to reassert the primacy of the voice of civilians, not of consumers in a consumerist society. There is no shortcut to that. It's the only way in which it can be done. But interestingly, what will empower people to do that is perceptions of self-interest. And I just want to come on to this business about human nature, because it would be foolish, I think, to assume that human beings are going to become so amazingly attuned to the suffering of other people and the planet that they're just going to be able to set to one side completely their own direct self-interest in all of these discussions and just say the world demands a different articulation of human nature in which self-interest is relegated to a second order expression of human nature, and we now need to do things with a different form of openness to other people and the planet and so on. I think that's not achievable. That's not a goal that we can arrive at. But there are modulated forms of self-interest that we need to get much smarter at working with. So, for instance, just think of how we might move from today's extremely crude, applied, narrow, individualistic self-interest to forms of self-interest where you demonstrate to people that their own individual interests are entirely contingent on, dependent on, meeting the needs and the self-interest of other people. So, to link, if I may, very quickly to the issue about France and population, it is true that because European politicians are now reflecting on what will happen to their economies as human populations in Europe decline by about 50 million over the next 40 years, particularly interestingly in Catholic countries. I only take time out to reflect on this mischievously, but it is, to me, hugely enjoyable that those European countries that have the lowest total fertility rates are those that has the highest level of Catholic preachiness. And I can't help but see that as a tremendous example of enlightenment despite power, as it were. So, anyway, that's nothing to do with the quote that you were using, but it sort of tickles me that Ireland and Italy have the lowest total fertility rates of any European countries today. The reason why I've mentioned this is that the answer to your question is that you don't need to grow the numbers within Western European countries by growing the population per se. We have already settled upon the idea that immigration is an extremely good way of getting many things done in our economy that people who currently live in our economies are not prepared to do. And as long as you can maintain this notion that immigration is an economic benefit and a socially manageable benefit for other people already living there, there isn't any reason why the needs of Europeans shouldn't be met partly by their own existing economic activity and by the continued increase in numbers through immigration. This goes to the heart of self-interest. When I showed you those population numbers for Europe, so that by 2050 there'll be 1.3 billion people living in North Africa and the Middle East, and a static population in Europe, the easiest way of explaining self-interest is to say, what do you think is going to happen to Europe in that world, where they're getting poorer, or certainly not getting better, and we're getting richer, and there are every year fewer of us relative to them? What do you think is going to happen? Do you think Fortress Europe is a viable model of success in an interconnected and interdependent world? Do you think we're going to be able to build physical barriers all the way along the south coast of Europe, from the southernmost tip of Portugal, all the way around the Mediterranean, the Adriatic, right through to Turkey, that we're going to be able to have an encampment, a fortified ghetto, gated community for the whole of Europe to stop the ingress of large numbers of people who will be sufficiently desperate to be prepared to take any risks to get access to a source of wealth as they see it over the border? This is the same situation on the Mexico-US border today. Last year, the American Border Patrol arrested 1 million people illegal entrants into America from Mexico and return them to the other side of the border. 1 million. A lot of people died, incidentally, trying to cross the border. Many, many people die every day in Europe trying to get from North Africa into Europe, crossing the Mediterranean in very dangerous boats, and hundreds of people are drowning without any knowledge at all, without people actually understanding the scale of the problem. There is no physical barrier you can build high enough to keep out desperate people who think that however bad it is in Europe or America, it's going to be better than the world they're leaving. So self-interest tells you, instead of pumping billions of dollars into building barriers, why don't you pump billions of dollars into making life better and bearable for the people in those countries? And why don't you start by investing in family planning? And again, we're getting into controversial territory here. But if you look at North African and Middle East countries, where total fertility rates are still in excess sometimes of 3 children per family, per couple, the simplest way we could protect our security in Europe would be to start putting huge amounts of money into intelligent, enlightened, progressive family planning practices across the whole of Africa and the Middle East. Now, you may turn on me and say, that sounds like a very reactionary viewpoint. Well, I'm prepared to take you on that score, because I know of no investment in human well-being that works better for people than family planning. Because you make family planning work by 3 things. There's no magic about family planning. 1, you invest in education for girls. 2, you invest in women's health care. And 3, you invest in access to a variety of different kinds of contraception. That is the lesson you can tease out of every single successful family planning intervention that has been done by education rather than by the kind of draconian system used in China. All of those investments work for a better future for those people. So self-interest, from that macro perspective, suddenly looks very different from what you might be hearing today from the right-wing parties, which are basically saying, protect your self-interest. Keep out all these people who want to come into Europe. Build higher barriers, bigger fences. Have more draconian systems to kick them out of the country once they've come in as illegal immigrants. All totally despairing and utterly useless. I mean, utterly useless. So if you want to protect your self-interest, you have to think differently about how you make your investments in people who don't share the benefits that we have. Those are the sort of connections which will begin to come through. Whether they're coming through fast enough at the moment, I don't know. And that doesn't quite answer your question about less, which is tricky, because people might be prepared to accept a reformulated understanding of self-interest. They're still a bit reluctant to think that self-interest equals less. And then we get into a rather more complicated psychological game than we're in at the moment. How much pain do we need in the system to persuade people that their self-interest is best reflected by people consuming less rather than with the way we consume today?
You have been listening to part 1 of a dialogue with famous British ecologist, author, and broadcaster Jonathan Porritt. This question and answer period followed his speech on A Sustainable Future, delivered in Vancouver, Canada, on May 2, 2007, and recorded by Radio EcoShock. Download that speech, free, from ecoshock.org in the Climate Solutions section.